I'm Shelley Schlender for MeAndMyDiabetes.com. Up next, Gary Taubes, author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat, makes a presentation to the University of Colorado Medical School. He's introduced here by CU Medical Professor Richard Johnson.
I've learned that science is really a moving science, and that often paradigms shift as more and more information is received. Today we're going to see an example of a paradigm shift hypothesis in which Gary Taubes is going to present to you a new look at obesity. And his approach is very interesting. He often goes back into the literature, back to the very beginnings of when a hypothesis starts, and then dissects it in a very analytic manner. His story is controversial, and certainly it's not resolved, but it's wonderful to have him to present his hypothesis to us. So Gary trained as a physicist, got a degree in physics at Harvard, and then he went on and did aerospace physics at Stanford, and then he switched into journalism, got a master's in journalism at Columbia. Over the last 20 years or so, he's become very famous for his work in dissecting out hypotheses from salt and the role of salt in blood pressure to the role of carbohydrates and sugar in obesity. He's had several books. Many of you have it in your hands. Good Calories, Bad Calories really took the country by storm. And it's been very exciting for me to follow his writings and his analyses of obesity. And I'm absolutely delighted that he accepted our invitation to come out and speak to us. Gary, it's a real pleasure to have you here. And he's going to talk today on why we get fat.
Thank you. Hi, thank you very much. Thanks, Rick. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to start with a little bit of background just for context, and then we'll take it from there. So the reason, we've got an obesity epidemic on our hands. In the past 40 years, obesity rates have increased 2.5-fold, and this is what this is about. So this isn't to talk about how to lose weight. It's to talk about why we get fat. And the obesity epidemic goes along with the diabetes epidemic, and these numbers are even more frightening because diabetes rates have increased fivefold since the early 1970s. And what's interesting, what I want you to keep in mind here is in 1956, the year I was born, there were less than 200 papers published in the Index Medical Literature on the Science of Obesity. And last year, there were over 16,000. Actually, 1974, here at the beginning, was a watershed year. That was the first year that over 1,000 papers were published in the medical literature on obesity. And, you can simply make the argument that this massive epidemic of literature on obesity has gone along with a massive increase in the rates of obesity, and there's been virtually no influence from what we've learned on stemming this epidemic. And if this were HIV numbers I was showing you, say Americans infected with HIV and AIDS, as the numbers continue to increase, we would be desperately looking for another explanation for the cause of the disorder. We wouldn't sit here and say, well, we know what causes the disease, right? We must have something wrong because we're having no effect. And if the antiretroviral therapies did virtually nothing, we would seriously question the idea that the HIV virus was the cause of AIDS. We haven't had that situation in obesity. Obesity, we believe we always understood pretty much the cause, and we still understand pretty much the cause. And the one way to think about what I did as a journalist is imagine you were head of the Obesity Society or head of the National Institutes of Health or the American Heart Association or the American Diabetes Association. You might say to yourself, look, over the past 40 years, we've had this massive increase in obesity and diabetes. We think we know what's going on. We think we've got it nailed, but maybe we don't. Maybe we screwed up. Maybe not only is our advice incorrect because we don't seem to be having any effect on how many people are getting obese, maybe our understanding of the underlying cause of the disorder is wrong. So let's get a reasonably smart postdoc who understands science and ask him to go back through the literature, fund him to go back through the literature and see if he could find an alternative hypothesis, some way we might have screwed up. Because the evidence that we screwed up is huge. Either the public isn't taking our advice or our advice isn't working, and if our advice isn't working, we have to understand why. So in effect, this is what happened with me. I stumbled into this field as a kind of an investigative science journalist. I had no preconceptions whatsoever. In 2002, I did a relatively infamous cover story for the New York Times Magazine called What If It's All Been a Big Fat Lie? That, as infamous cover stories for the New York Times Magazine do, they got me a large book advance. The large book advance then funded the next 4 years of my life to do the research and writing that led to this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. The book, of course, took 5 years, which is why I don't want my children to go into journalism. This book was done. The advantage I had over other research in the past is that the internet made it possible to track down virtually every primary source. At one point in my research, I had five undergraduates and graduate students at universities around the country doing nothing for me but going to the medical school libraries and Xeroxing primary sources that couldn't be gotten, for instance, at Columbia Presbyterian's library in Manhattan. So in the course of 5 years, I could do the research that would have taken 30 or 40 years going from library to library to library pre-internet. The problem is it led to a book that's so dense and so densely annotated that it's virtually unreadable. But when it came out, I still had people sending me emails saying, look, you know, this book changed my life. Would you please write one that is readable that I could give that I could give to my father, or I could give to my brother, or I could give to my doctor. I had doctors writing, asking me to write a book that I could give to their patients. So the result was Why We Get Fat. And I point these books out because this lecture is a very condensed version of both of these books. And obviously I'm trying to spread some fairly radical ideas, and I'm hoping that you'll find it at least thought-provoking, and thought-provoking enough so that if you're in the healthcare profession, or you have a weight problem or a diabetes problem yourself, you think maybe I should read one. So the other thing to keep in mind, the other subtext for this, is with obesity, you know, comes a cluster of chronic diseases. We know this. The more obese you are, the higher risk of virtually every major chronic disease, stroke, heart disease, gallbladder disease, diabetes, neurodegeneration, which now includes Alzheimer's, asthma, fatty liver disease, and most cancers. And so the conventional wisdom is that as we get fat, something about the process of being fat, the state of being fat, maybe the inflammatory molecules released, cause or increase the risk for these other diseases. But the argument I'm making is that in effect, whatever makes us fat, this is a simpler causal pathway, that whatever makes us fat also is the environmental trigger of these other diseases. And so this talk could be what makes us sick instead of what makes us fat, or why do we get sick. So at the end, that's just one thing to keep in mind. It's not just about weight. It's about all these chronic diseases. And I'm saying that the same likely environmental trigger in one is the same likely environmental trigger in all of them. It might not be, but that would be the most parsimonious hypothesis. So the conventional wisdom on why we get fat is simple, right? Fundamental cause of obesity and overweight is an energy imbalance between calories consumed and calories expended. You know, in the literature, you'll see this phrase, obesity is an energy balance disorder. Calories in are greater than calories out. And by the way, I have to apologize. The thing to move the slides is counterintuitively reversed, so I'll be going back and forth a lot more than I planned. Anyway, calories in greater than calories out. You know, we overeat, simply put. And it's pretty much intuitive. It's a very powerful idea. And then with this idea, we have to explain the obesity epidemic itself, because one of the things you want to do in any science, I mean, one of the goals of science is to explain the observations, and the observation that we're worried about is this dramatic increase in obesity, and that's done pretty much here. You know, increased prosperity. This is a phrase that Marion Nestle, the NYU nutritionist, used back in 2002, and the idea is that as societies get more prosperous, as they get wealthier, you have more energy-dense fuel available, more, you know, in effect, tasty, energy-dense food is available everywhere, from convenience stores. It's cheap at fast food joints and vending machines, probably in the hallways here, and so you can't walk more than 20 feet before you have to, you can refuel, in effect. And this goes along with no real need for physical activity, no motivation to be, other than personal good health, to be physically active. So we keep our kids home from school. We don't let them walk to school anymore, ride to school. They don't even have PE in many schools anymore. And this goes along with this proliferation of you know, computers, video games, iPads. So no one even goes out to play anymore. Certainly my kids don't. And so we have this sort of toxic environment, which is a phrase coined by Kelly Brown now at Yale. And this is why we have this increase in obesity. Another phrase we see now is an obesogenic environment. So here's how this hypothesis looks. Too much food, too little physical activity leads to overeating, basically energy in greater than energy out. And the result is obesity and the obesity epidemic. So just to get a feel, how many of you kind of believe this? Okay, excellent. I actually gave this talk at Tufts, at the nutrition department at Tufts University, which is one of the primary, over the past 40 years, they've been drivers of the conventional wisdom in nutrition. I said, how many of you believe this? And nobody raised their hand. And I said, well, then I guess I can go, because I was, and yeah, my goal is to convince you that this is not only incorrect, it's actually nonsensical, and then they all raise their hand. So from the beginning, we're just going to treat this as a hypothesis, because it is a hypothesis. It might be dictated by the laws of physics somehow, and we think that it was, you know, handed down on stone tablets from Mount Sinai, but we can treat it as a hypothesis because we're allowed to do that in any science. And so what we do in a situation like this, first thing obviously, is to see if we can find counterexamples. Can we find examples of obesity, the populations with high rates of obesity that don't have this kind of toxic environment that we're blaming obesity on today? Can we find previous obesity epidemics? And what's interesting is if you go through the literature, which I have and did, you can find a lot of them. And these are the dozen that stood out. And beginning up at the top, 1928, the Sioux on the South Dakota Crow Creek Reservation. So this is a study done by two University of Chicago economists in the year before the Depression. And what was interesting is the first thing they pointed out in their study was that the poverty on this reservation was so profound that it was almost unimaginable by the standards of 1928. So you could imagine how unimaginable it would be from our point of view. So these Native Americans lived 4 to 8 people per room in these one-room shacks. They had no running water. They had no plumbing. They basically got all their food from government rations. And yet these University of Chicago researchers pointed out that 40% of the women, 10% of the men, and 25% of the children were distinctly fat. And 25% of the women, 25% of the men and children were extremely thin. So you have this combination of obesity coexisting with malnutrition or undernutrition that today is known as the double or dual burden of obesity and malnutrition. We're going to come back to it because it's a very important observation. So then we could go down to 61-63 Trinidad. Trinidad was having a malnutrition crisis. People were dying of deficiency diseases. The U.S. government sent a team of researchers down to help out. And they come back reporting that a third of the women over 25 are obese. And that obesity is a potentially serious medical problem in women. And the next year, an MIT nutritionist goes down to quantify the diet being consumed and comes back reporting that the per capita daily diet was less than 2,000 calories. It was 21% fat. And this was fewer calories than were recommended at the time by the Food and Agriculture Organization as necessary for a healthy diet. Bantu pensioners in 64-65, this is a top study. These are the poorest of a disenfranchised black population in South Africa pre-apartheid. And yet the mean weight of the women over 60 was 165 pounds, and 30% of the women were severely overweight. If you go down to 1974, Chilean factory workers, 30% were obese, 10% were undernourished. There's that double burden again. And yet nearly the most were engaged in heavy labor. These were people who were working on a construction line in Chilean factories. So they don't belong to gyms. They're not training for marathons or triathlons. They're not power walking 45 minutes a day, but they're doing hard physical labor 10, 12 hours a day. We can be pretty confident they're more physically active than we are. And yet they had these high levels of obesity. Nearly half the women over 54 were obese. And then finally in 1981, Mexican-Americans in Starr County, Texas. This was a study done by a University of Texas cardiologist. Starr County, Texas, about 200 miles due south of San Antonio. It's right on the Mexican border. Most of the inhabitants were employed in agricultural labor and they worked in the oil fields in the country. So again, these are a poor, hardworking, physically active group of individuals. And yet 50% of the women in their 50s are obese and 40% of the men in their 40s. And there was one restaurant in Starr County, Texas. In 1981. It was a Mexican restaurant. So there's none of this toxic environment on which we blame obesity today and the obesity epidemic, and yet there are high levels of obesity. And so one of the ideas is we have to be able to explain this. Any theory of obesity has to be able to explain obesity in a population that doesn't have computers, video games, televisions, iPads. They don't have vending machines and fast food joints on every corner. They don't have the energy-dense food. So what's going on? And here's a modern example of this. This was a paper published just last year. These are Western Saharan refugees living in four refugee camps and outside of Tindouf City in the Sahara Desert in Algeria. These people were run out of Western Sahara in around 1976 when there was a revolution. They settled in these camps. Their life depends on food from international aid organizations. And yet 28% of the households have 35% of the households have overweight individuals in them, and 28% have this double burden, obesity and malnutrition or undernutrition, stunted children coexisting. So the question is, why were these populations fat? Why are these populations fat? Because one, again, of underlying principle in all good science is Occam's razor. We never complicate a hypothesis if a simple one will do. If we could figure out why they were fat, when we have none of this toxic environment, we could probably figure out why we're fat. Okay, so here's how this question was phrased in 1973. Ralph Richards was a British diabetes specialist. In the early 1960s, he moves to Jamaica and he opens a diabetes clinic in Kingston. And in 1973, he's at a conference in London, and he reports that two-thirds of the adult women in Kingston are obese. Two-thirds of them. Okay, and he says it's difficult to explain the high frequency of obesity seen in a relatively impecunious society such as exists in the West Indies when compared to the standard of living enjoyed in the more developed countries. So he's asking the same question. We expect obesity to associate with prosperity, with a lot of food and no need to be physically active, and yet here you have these incredible numbers, levels of obesity in a very poor country. Malnutrition and subnutrition are common disorders in the first 2 years of life. Subnutrition continues in early childhood to the early teens. Obesity begins to manifest itself in the female population from the 25th year of life and reaches enormous proportions from 30 onward. Now, here's that same question. Here is that same question. Let's try that. Bingo. 2005. So in 1973, when Richards gave that, obesity was still thought of as a type of malnutrition. Okay, something was wrong with the food. You don't know what. Mid-70s, obesity is a form of overnutrition. This idea set in like ice on a pond. It's from too much food and prosperity. And by 2005, Benjamin Caballero, head of the Laboratory of Human Nutrition, Johns Hopkins, writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine on this dual burden of obesity and malnutrition. He starts it off this way. He says, a few years ago, I was visiting a primary care clinic in the slums of Sao Paulo. The waiting room was full of mothers with thin, stunted young children exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition. Their appearance sadly would surprise few who visit poor urban areas in the developing world. What might come as a surprise that many of the mothers holding those undernourished infants were themselves overweight. And then he says the coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to public health programs since the aims of programs to reduce undernutrition, which would make more food available, right, are obviously in conflict with those for obesity prevention, which is make less food available. I put this poses a challenge to public health programs in bold italics because the coexistence of underweight and overweight, this dual burden of obesity and malnutrition in populations and in families, doesn't pose a challenge to your public health program. It poses a challenge to your belief system. Okay? It's a clash of paradigms. If you believe that these mothers got obese merely because they consumed superfluous calories that their bodies didn't need, then you have to be able to explain why they did not give those superfluous calories to their starving, undernourished, stunted children. Okay? We have a paradigm of maternal behavior that says that mothers will starve before they will let their children starve. And we have a paradigm of obesity that says that the mothers got fat merely because they snuck outside and ate Snickers bars. Okay, how many of you are mothers in here? How many of you would let your children starve so you could overeat? Okay, See the problem? I mean, we're laughing, but, you know, in one of the things, another thing you want to do in science is find what's called, known as anomalous observations. An anomalous observation is an observation that your theory can't explain. That physicists, where I grew up, physicists just spent $10 billion building one particle accelerator in a laboratory in Switzerland so they could create an observation that their theories can't explain. Here's an observation. We have these two competing paradigms. We have to be able to explain them. Okay, and you can do it. I mean, you can figure out ways that the kids are undernourished because they have more diarrheal diseases, and it can be done. But fundamentally, you have to throw out one of your paradigms. And I prefer to throw out the obesity paradigm, because if I didn't, my mother would kill me. Okay, so let's look at some more reasons to question the energy balance hypothesis. The first one is if eating too much makes us fat, then eating less should make us lean, and it doesn't work. We've always known it doesn't work. And the cocky, if you look at clinical trials of calorie-restricted diets, weight loss is so small as to be clinically insignificant. You know, you can merely ask the question, should this be surprising that people don't lose weight when you calorie-restrict them, and at least in clinical trials? And Hilda Brook was the leading authority on pediatric obesity in the mid-20th century. How many of you know who Hilda Brook was, who didn't read my books? Okay, you should know these people if you're involved in obesity in any way. Hilda Brook, you know, these are the people who are the equivalents of the Einsteins and the Schrodingers and the Plancks in physics. Okay, these are the great minds in obesity in the mid to early 20th century. Hilda Brook was one of them. And in this book, The Importance of Overweight, she pointed out, she said, more than in any other illness, a physician treating the obese patient is called upon only to do a special trick, to make the patient do something. Stop eating after it's already been proven that you cannot do it. Everyone who's overweight and obese knows they should eat less. Okay, that's been, you know, it's the obvious thing to try. And the idea is if you can't lose weight, if you're still overweight and obese, it obviously hasn't worked. And so the fact that a doctor in a white coat or a dietitian or a researcher tells you to eat less, it shouldn't be surprising when we find out that these studies tend to be failures. The other problem is exercising more doesn't seem to work. Increasing energy expenditure doesn't seem to work. And I could cite meta-analyses showing how small the effect is in randomized controlled trials, but I find this more compelling. 2007, the American Heart Association, the American College of Sports Medicine, write joint physical activity guidelines. And these are people who want us to be physically active. They think physical activity is an inherent part of a healthy lifestyle, as do I. And you would expect them to spin the evidence in favor of physical activity. And this is what they say about the hypothesis that increasing energy expenditure
beating the odds against sugar, processed food, obesity, and disease. For more interviews like this, check out MeAndMyDiabetes.com
compared with those who have low energy expenditure. Okay, so it's reasonable to assume that if you're a couch potato, you'll be less likely to gain weight over time if you become a marathon runner than if you remain a couch potato. Same logic. And then they say so far data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. And the point is this hypothesis is roughly, depending on how you want to date it, 100 to 150 years old. And if the best you could say about a hypothesis after 100 to 150 years is that the data are not particularly compelling, you should seriously entertain the possibility that your hypothesis is wrong. Doesn't mean it is. Maybe the studies weren't done right. But after that period of time, you know, this is your best bet. So now, I'm going to give you a simple reason to understand why this is important. Imagine tonight that I'm having a dinner at Rick Johnson's house. Okay, and we have the 12 best chefs in Denver and Boulder coming over to cook dinner. Okay, it's like Top Chef, Denver. Okay, they are going to cook the best food you've ever tasted in your life, and there's going to be course after course after course after course. We're going to have 18 appetizers cooked, and 7 main courses, and 5 desserts, and you all get invitations to come. And the invitations say, best food you've ever had, it's a feast of monumental proportions, bring your appetite. What do you think you would do to make sure that when you got to my house, Rick's house, tonight for dinner, you had brought your appetite? You were hungry enough to eat all this food. Okay? Any ideas? Yeah. You might exercise. right? Increase your energy expenditure during the day. If you're planning on working out, you're going to work out harder. If you weren't planning on working out, you're going to go to the gym. Maybe you're going to say, hey, Rick only lives 5 miles from here. Let's walk. We'll build up an appetite. Remember the concept of building up an appetite? And you might also eat less during the day. Skip lunch or eat a small lunch. You'd certainly skip your afternoon snacks. You might cut back on breakfast. So the point is, why is it that the two things that we would do, any normal human being would do to assure that we're hungry, are the two things that we tell obese people to do to lose weight? And that alone should tell you there's a problem, right? Okay, the energy balance challenge. Here's another problem. The CDC tells us weight management is all about balance, balancing the number of calories you consume with the number of calories your body uses or burns off. How many of you have tried to lose weight or maintain your weight by this idea of counting calories or have told patients to do it? Okay. I'm now going to give you a calculation that I first saw done in a 1937 metabolism textbook written by the leading metabolism researcher in the U.S. pre-World War II, and it was written in there to make the point I'm about to make. What we want to know is, let's say you're lean and in your 20s, okay, and you want to remain lean. So you don't want to gain 2 pounds a year, which would be 20 pounds a decade, because if you did that, by the time you're in your mid-40s, you would be obese like most or a large proportion of Americans, and you want to avoid becoming obese. So you just ask this question, how do I have to match calories in to calories out to prevent this 20 pounds per decade weight gain? Okay, so here's the mathematics. It's eighth grade mathematics. A typical adult's food intake is about 2,700 calories a day. That's an average between men and women in the U.S. It's 1 million calories a year. It's about 10 million calories in a decade. It's about 10 to 12 tons of food. So here's the question, how accurately do I have to match calories into calories out so that I don't gain more than 20 pounds over the course of a decade? And the answer is 21 calories a day. If I stick 21 calories a day in my fat tissue that I do not burn, I will gain 20 pounds in a decade. Here's a calculation. It's, like I said, eighth grade mathematics. Anyone could have told you this before I did. 20 calories a day times 365 days in a year times 10 years divided by roughly 3,500 calories per pound of fat, which is a rough measure of the energy content of a pound of fat, comes to 21 pounds in a decade. So if I eat, say, 150 bites of food, and each bite is 20 calories, and I only burn off 149 of them, burn off or excrete, and the 150th ends up in my fat tissue, I am going to become obese, preordained, okay? How is this possible? How can we possibly monitor calories in to calories out with that kind of accuracy? This is what Eugene Dubois was saying. It's 0.8% accuracy, okay? We don't even have, even if you knew precisely the energy in the food you were consumed, you're only guessing the energy you're expending day in, day out, okay? As Dubois said, he said, there's no, considering this calculation, there's no stranger phenomenon than maintenance of a constant body weight under marked variation in bodily activity and food consumption. If what we have to do to maintain our weight is balance our intake to our expenditure, somehow by our brains, consciously or unconsciously, the question isn't, why are some of us fat? The question should be, why aren't all of us fat? Or why don't half of us look fat and the other half of us look emaciated? Because the mathematics works both ways. So let's ask some other questions. What's wrong with this energy balance, calories in, calories out idea? Now I'm going to show photos of naked human beings, which you do not see that often in modern textbooks. You see photos on occasion of naked fat rats. These photos are all taken from pre-World War II textbooks. And prior to World War II, what I'm now going to be doing is channeling the way pre-World War II European clinicians thought about obesity. These were clinical investigators who both saw obese patients as patients and studied them. They took histories from their patients, and they thought it was very important not just to know whether or not your patient is obese, you know, BMI over 30 or not, a number, but how they get fat, where they get fat, and when they get fat, because that tells you something about the fattening process. What we want to know is, why do people get fat? So from here on in, I am channeling the theory that the pre-World War II clinical investigators in Germany and Austria had come to accept. So one of the things they pointed out is we know obesity is a large genetic component that's been studied since the 1930s. It's been always been known because obesity runs in family, body types run in families. identical twins, right? They have don't just have the same faces, they have the same bodies. So what controls that? And over here on the left, we have a lean pair of identical twins, and on the right, we have an obese pair of identical twins, and our calories in, calories out theory might tell us why the obese pair is heavier. They took in more calories than they expended. The lean pair practiced perfect energy balance. Why do they have the same bodies? Why does the fat go to the same place? What determines that? Certainly our energy balance tells us nothing about that, but something is regulating that. So here's another way to look at it, animal husbandry. You know, we've been breeding animals to have different characteristics for probably thousands of years. You know, on the left here, we have a Jersey cow. It's a dairy cow. You can see the swollen udder. You can see how lean it is with the ribs showing. And on the right, an Aberdeen Angus is a meat cow. You can see the fatty meat in the inset. And you could just ask the question, we know it's genetic, right, because they're different breeds. What's regulating this? What are the genes doing that's regulating how fat these animals, lean these animals are? Are they regulating how much energy they take in and expend? Are they regulating, for instance, how many calories per bite of grass or corn or whatever else these cows are eating, or how many bites they take during the day, or how many days they spend grazing compared to sitting? Are they regulating? Maybe that they make the Jersey want to go for a run at night, like that old Far Side cartoon, and the Aberdeen Angus goes into the barn and watches television. You know, and it's obvious that that doesn't make any sense when we're talking about in this criteria. So a different way to look at it. You know, all ethical and moral issues aside, what we want out of the Jersey is to take fuel and convert it to milk. So it's going to take fuel on one side, convert it to milk, it's a very energy expensive activity, and we don't want those fuel cluttering up in, you know, fat and protein in its body. So we want it to take the fuel it consumes and partition it into milk as efficiently as possible. And the Aberdeen Angus, we want it to take the fuel it consumes, and we want it to partition it into protein and fat on its body. So maybe what this fuel is doing, what these genes are doing that's regulating the leanness versus obesity is not controlling how much they take in or expend, but how they use the fuel they take in. Okay, do they partition it to milk? Do they partition it to fat and protein? Do they allocate it to fat and protein? And we don't know how that's being done, but if we start thinking about these genes as fuel partitioning genes or fuel allocation genes, we can start understanding something about what's the difference between these two species. So sexual variations, you know, men get fat above the waist, women get fat below the waist, right? Both these people would have taken in more calories than they expend by our energy balance idea, but why did the fat go above the waist on the man and below the waist on the woman? Okay? And you, one way to think about it is, you know, the fat cells in the man expanded with fat in his abdomen, but the fat cells in the women didn't. And the fat cells in the hips and buttocks, the gluteal deposits in the woman expanded with fat, but the fat gluteal fat in the man didn't. Something's obviously regulating that. The idea that they took in more calories than they expended is irrelevant. Okay, we know that. That's a given. And actually, this man doubled his risk of heart disease by getting fat above the waist. The woman did not. So you just ask the question, this is how I want you to think about it. This is how I learned to think about it through the German and Austrian researchers. What does calories have to do with it? What we want to know is, why did the man get fat here? Why did it double his risk of heart disease? Why did she get fat there? The calories in, calories out thing tells us nothing. Just what do the calories have to do with it? Who cares? Puberty. Boys and girls enter puberty with roughly the same amount of body fat. As the boys go through puberty, they lose fat and gain muscle. And because they're getting bigger and heavier, they're taking in more calories than they expend. The girls go through puberty and they gain fat in very specific places. And because they're getting bigger and heavier, they're taking in more calories than they expend. So taking in more calories than they expend is a given. We don't care. The question is, why do the boys lose fat and gain muscle, and the girls gain fat? And why do they don't gain it everywhere. They gain it in specific places designed, arguably, by evolution to drive the boys crazy. So the point is, what do the calories have to do with it? Who cares that they took in more calories than they expended? Why did the boys gain muscle and the girls gain fat? And we know the answer, obviously. It's sex hormones. And we know why they were getting bigger. It's growth hormones. So there are all these endocrinological explanations for their growth that we're interested in. The calories in, calories out thing, who cares? It's a given. Okay, lipodystrophies. This will be the last slide I'll show. By the time I got to this in my book, my editor was saying, you know, Gary, the book is beginning to look like a freak show. Move on, will you? Okay. Progressive lipid dystrophy. There are about 200 cases of this on record by the 1950s. About 80% of them are in women. This was, again, a photo from a pre-World War II textbook. This was a case that dated to the late 19th century, early 20th century. This woman had a BMI of greater than 30, a BMI of 34, so clinically she's obese. She had this progressive lipid dystrophy where, in these cases, the women, they start losing subcutaneous fat in their forehead, and it progresses downward, hence the term. And eventually they get to the point where they look completely emaciated. They have no subcutaneous fat virtually at all. And then often you get this lower body obesity developing separately. So it's not like as they're losing fat here, they're getting fat here and the fat's just moving. First they lose fat above the waist, then later on they get fat below the waist. And the way these Europeans use this example, they said, look, are we going to blame the top half on undereating and the bottom half on overeating? And it's obvious that that's absurd, right? But then it's a logical thing to say, if we can't blame localized obesity on overeating or localized emaciation on undereating, how can we blame global obesity? What right do we have to jump to that conclusion? And if this woman had 5 more pounds of fat on her upper body, you wouldn't notice the lipodystrophy. And if she walked into your office, you'd say, you're eating too much, and you've got to eat less and exercise more, and just treat her as an obese subject. But this kind of thought experiment says, look, we can see from this localized obesity in this context that this overeating idea doesn't work. We need a better one. So why do we believe? And the answer is physics, laws of energy balance. And what's interesting is whenever anyone argues like I do that this energy balance, calories in, calories out thing is meaningless, we're accused of not understanding the laws of thermodynamics. I was actually on the Larry King show when Good Calories, Bad Calories came out, and Jillian Michaels, a trainer from The Biggest Loser, came on from Los Angeles and gave me a lecture on thermodynamics on national television. And after we went to a commercial break, I turned to Mehmet Oz, who was sitting next to me, and I said, I have a physics degree from Harvard. And Jillian Michaels just lectured me on thermodynamics. And you can watch this cut on TV. I'm, like, literally speechless. It's on YouTube. We believe this stuff about calories because of the first law of thermodynamics, which is the law of energy conservation. Simply put, energy is not created nor destroyed. It's the one law of thermodynamics that's easy to understand. Okay, so the idea is if a system gets more massive, it takes in more energy than it expends. If a system gets less massive, doesn't matter what the system is, it's got to expend more than it takes in because we can't create energy from nowhere and we can't make energy vanish. It can only change forms. Okay, it's a very simple law, and it gets translated into this energy balance equation. Delta E, the change of energy in a system, is equal to the energy that goes in minus the energy that goes out. Okay, and in terms of our obesity issue, delta E becomes our fat stores, our energy stores. And so change in fat mass equal to energy consumed minus energy expended. And what we do with this law, we say, look, if E in goes up, if I eat more, and E out doesn't change, I don't compensate by exercising more, then delta E becomes positive and I start storing energy. Therefore, eating too much causes obesity. And if E out goes down, if I become sedentary, I have an accident or something, I break my leg, and I don't compensate by eating less, delta E becomes positive, I start storing energy, therefore sedentary behavior causes obesity. So it makes perfect sense. It's completely logical. The problem is there is no arrow of causality in this law. By that I mean all the laws of thermodynamics say are if a system gets bigger, this is what happens, and if it gets less massive, this is what happens. But it says nothing about why the system gets more or less massive. For instance, a star could get more massive, but we know that it's not eating more. You know, it just says this is what, it, so it's an association. And this is the way the universe works. It's a law, it's always true. But it tells us nothing about causality. So one way to think about it, a metaphor, is imagine we're walking by the hallway here, and we look in and we see that this room is packed with energy. So you want to ask me, why is this room so crowded with energy? Same way we want to know why that person's fat tissue is so full of energy. Okay? So it's an equivalent thing. And so you say to me, Gary, why is that room so full of energy? And I say, because more people entered than left. Which is the equivalent of saying more energy entered than left, which is the equivalent of saying that person got fat because they more energy entered than left. Have I told you anything you didn't know? Okay? It's obvious more people entered than left because the room is crowded. That's a given. So you say to me, Gary, that's a given. I want a real answer, not this bogus more people entered than left thing. So I say, ah, okay, but if more people enter than leave, it's got to get more crowded, right? Which is equivalent of saying, if you eat more than you expend, you have to get fatter. Have I told you anything yet? Are you still satisfied with my answer? And I hope by this time you're ready to slap me. Okay, so what could be an explanation? Why could this room be so full of energy? Maybe there's a lecture going on. Maybe there's a compelling speaker. Maybe there's free drinks in here. Maybe you notice that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt had stumbled in and were sitting in the front row. Okay, maybe the air conditioning worked in here, but nowhere else in the building. It was 95 degrees out there and 72 in here. Maybe the fire alarms went off outside. And the sprinkler system was on. This was the only room that wasn't wet. Maybe there are large members of the University of Colorado football team standing at the door, throwing people in and not letting them leave. These are all explanations for why this room is full of energy in the form of people. Okay, they talk about the conditions inside the room, the speaker, the free drinks, Angelina and Brad, the temperature. The difference between the conditions inside and outside, the temperature differential, right, the water outside from the sprinklers, it's dry in here, and even the conditions at the boundary, the big football players throwing people in and not letting them out. These are all meaningful explanations. That more energy in the form of people came in than left is meaningless. It's a given. And in fact, it doesn't even tell you whether the room's crowded. It only tells you that it's getting more crowded if that's happening. And so the point is, when you say the same thing about obesity, that people got fat because they took in more energy than they expended, you are saying nothing. If they got fatter, they took in more energy than they expended. That is a given. This is the single biggest mistake that was made in obesity research. It was embraced. It was always there, but it was embraced in the 1950s. And it became the conventional wisdom, and nobody questioned it. I didn't question it. It seems obvious. The laws of thermodynamics say nothing about obesity. They're completely irrelevant. They're always true, Jillian, but they say nothing about why we get fat. And when I was lecturing recently to a group of cardiologists at the Mayo Clinic, I said, look, why is it that from the moment you enter medical school to the moment you retire, the only disorder you will ever diagnose with a physics textbook is obesity? This is biology, folks. It's endocrinology. It's physiology. Physics has nothing to do with it. The laws of thermodynamics are always true. The energy balance equation is irrelevant. If somebody's getting fatter, I guarantee you they're taking more energy than they expend. Okay, as long as they're getting heavier. And if they're getting leaner, I guarantee you they're expending more than they're taking in. Given. Let's never discuss it again. And if you say it to your patients, you're telling them nothing. You're telling them that lecture hall was crowded because more people entered than left. Okay, the alternative hypothesis. There is an alternative hypothesis. I'll give you the history of it a second. In this hypothesis, instead of saying obesity is a sort of energy balance or overeating or sedentary behavior, you start off with first principles. Again, a good rule of science is to begin with the simplest possible definition of the problem that does not have any assumptions attached. Obesity is a disorder of excess fat accumulation. Can anybody question that? Okay, you could say having too much fat is a disorder of having too much fat. Sounds inanely simple, but if you did that, the very first question you might ask yourself is, I wonder what regulates fat accumulation? Because when you're telling people they got fat by eating too much or exercising too little, you don't care what regulates fat accumulation. If anything, you care what regulates the behaviors of eating and physical activity. We care about what regulates fat accumulation in fat cells. So obesity is a sort of excess fat. Overeating and inactivity are compensatory effects. They're not causes. I'll explain that in a second. And the way it was phrased to me by researchers who study weight regulation in animals, and by the way it was explained in these pre-World War II textbooks, we don't get fat because we overeat. We overeat because our fat tissue is accumulating excess fat. Okay? We want to know why. So here is the direction of causality in the first law of thermodynamics. The conventional wisdom, E in and E out, cause changes in delta E. So the behaviors of E in and E out, of how much we eat and exercise, cause changes in physiology, the storage of fat in the human body. And in this alternative hypothesis, the physiology drives behavior. So something is dysregulating energy storage, And that's driving changes in energy in and energy out. So in our conventional wisdom, behavior causes changes in physiology. In this hypothesis, changes in physiology cause changes in behavior. In both cases, the laws of thermodynamics hold true because they always hold true. So here's one analogy that was used by the pre-World War II Europeans, a growing child. Okay, I've kind of done this already with puberty, but I'm going to do it again. On the left is a very cute kid who now lives in Oakland, California. When he was 1 year old, he weighed 20 pounds. Okay, 3 years later, he's 2009, he's gained 25 pounds. He's taken in more energy than he expended, right? He's grown, but he didn't grow because he overate. Because he was in positive energy balance. He was in positive energy balance because he grew. And the growth was caused by growth hormones stimulating insulin-like growth factor, and boom, you've got a growing child. You know, those of you who are parents know that when kids go through growth spurts, they tend to often eat voraciously, lie around the house all day long, and they exhibit hyperphagia and sedentary behavior. But it's not the hyperphagia and sedentary behavior that's driving the growth, it's the growth that's driving the compensatory behavioral changes. Okay, here's another example, a pathological example, cancer. Here's a tumor growing. That tumor's in positive energy balance. But that is not why it's growing. Okay, it's growing because there are oncogenes that are defective and tumor suppressive genes that aren't working, that's driving this thing to unfettered growth, and it is taking in as much energy as it can to fuel that growth. But growth is the cause, hyperphagia is the effect. And I would argue that that is true in every biological system with the sole exception of obesity, where we suddenly decide we're going to flip it and blame everything on positive energy balance. Okay, so here's this hypothesis. Lipophilia was a concept that was put forth first by Gustav von Bergmann in 1908. Von Bergmann was the leading German authority on internal medicine in the first half of the 20th century. Okay, the most prestigious award in the German Society of Internal Medicine today is the Gustav von Bergmann Medal. Okay, this was no quack. And von Bergmann made the observation there was a case of a young girl who had a bad burn on her hand. They did a graft from her stomach onto her hand, and she grew up to become obese. And she had this big puff of fat on the back of her hand. And von Bergmann went, this is fascinating. Obviously, you know, she doesn't have fat on this hand, so obviously there's some aspect, some characteristics of the tissue itself that regulates whether or not a tissue will expand with fat. And we could take that tissue from the stomach, move it somewhere else, and those variables, those aspects, whatever they are, go with it. And he called this lipophilia for love of fat, and it's the tendency of a tissue to expand with fat. And the idea was that there are tissues on the human body that do not absorb fat. For instance, our foreheads and the back of our hands are not places we get fat, unless you take some skin from the stomach. And there are other places where we do get fat, and this must be regulated. And a metaphor they used was hair growth. We grow hair in some places, but not others. The hairiest people in the world still have some places, well, maybe, that they don't grow hair. So obviously this is very carefully, this is regulated. And some people are hairier than others, and they said some people are fatter than others. And what we want to know is what regulates fat accumulation in fat cells, because then we'll learn why these people, why we get fat in some places and not others, why some people get fatter than others. And so von Bergmann put this idea forth. Julius Bauer was a pioneer in endocrinology, chronic disease, and genetics at the University of Vienna. He is still famous in Austria today. He took it up and was a leading proponent through the late 1920s into the 1930s. He fled Austria in 1938 when the Nazis, the Germans invaded. And the idea was more or less fully accepted in Europe by 1940. And the problem is 1940 was a very bad year. And so this theory vanishes with the war. And what's interesting is pre-war, not only was the best science done in Germany and Austria, medical science, physics, you name it, all these fields that are relevant to obesity, metabolism, nutrition, genetics, endocrinology, were all invented in German and Austria and pioneered in German and Austria. And the lingua franca of science pre-war was German, which is something I never thought about or realized. And then the war comes, and post-war, in fields like physics, we embrace these European researchers who fled the Nazis because we had a Cold War to fight and we had bombs to build, and so we didn't really care about the ideology of these people or their accents. But in medicine and public health, we shunned them. And one of the reasons Israel has such good medical research is because a lot of them ended up in Israel. A lot of them were Jews. And as with this shunning of the Germans and Austrians themselves came a shunning of the German literature. So the lingua franca of science switches from pre-war, where it's German, to English post-war, and I document this in my book. So obesity research goes from citing the German research pre-war to ignoring it post-war. And so this theory basically vanishes with the war. It's fascinating. When I was doing my research, I knew nothing about this. So here's how Bauer described this theory. He said, like a malignant tumor like the fetus, the uterus or the breast of a pregnant woman, the abnormal lipophilic tissue seizes on foodstuffs, even in the case of undernutrition. So we could start explaining our double burden if we start thinking this way. Because it doesn't matter what the person is doing, how much they're eating. They can be undernourished, and like a tumor, the fat tissue will grow anyway. It maintains its stock and may increase it independent of the requirements of the organism. A sort of anarchy exists. The adipose tissue lives for itself and does not fit into the precisely regulated management of the whole organism. So you could ask this question. You could look at animal models of obesity, and there are dozens of them, and you could simply ask the question, what happens with these animal models of obesity if you calorie restrict them? You can calorie restrict them from birth if you want, whether genetic models, surgical models, food models. And Jean Maillard, who was the leading nutritionist in the U.S. in the 1960s and into the 1970s, and in the 1950s at Harvard, he studied a strain of obese mice. And as he said, these mice will make fat out of their food under the most unlikely circumstances, even when half starved. Because they don't get fat because they eat too much. They get fat if they eat at all. There were experiments done in the late 1970s by MRC Greenwood at UC Santa Cruz, where she took strains of obese rats and basically calorie restricted them from birth. And the ones who were calorie restricted actually had more fat on their bodies than the ones who were allowed to eat ad libitum. They weighed less, but they had more fat and they had smaller brains and smaller organs. And what she saw was this drive to accumulate fat was so great that even when calorie restricted, they continued to do it. They just cannibalize their other organs, in effect. They didn't let their other organs get the fuel they needed. So you could think of these things as causing lipophilia when you do these interventions. So now you just ask the question, if obesity is sort of excess fat accumulation, what regulates fat accumulation? This was worked out from the 1920s to the 1960s. A lot of German emigres involved, actually, and some brilliant work. And when I was doing this part of the research, I actually got mad. It's because I'm a big fan of science and good science. When you're telling people they got obese because they took in more energy than they expended, you don't care about what regulates fat accumulation. You simply don't care. And this is a disorder of excess fat accumulation. It's a little crazy. Entire textbooks are written and lay books, which they never discuss what regulates the accumulation of fat in the fat cell. So by the German, this lipophilia theory vanishes by 1940. And then in the mid-1950s, researchers come along and invent a way to measure fatty acids in the bloodstream accurately. In 1959, Yalow and Burson invent the radioimmunoassay to measure hormones carefully. By the early 1960s, much of this is worked out. So this is the basics of it. A lot of you, if you're doctors, are taught this in med school, but you're not taught that this is relevant to obesity, which I think is a little odd. So fat is stored as triglycerides. This is what you have to know, is basically the triglyceride fatty acid cycle and usage in the human body. So we store fat as triglycerides, and you can see here, you know, a long fatty acid in the upper right there, and it's bonded together with the glycerol, and you end up with this big triglyceride. And so we burn fatty acids for fuel, and we move fatty acids in and out of cells for fuel, and I'll explain that in a second. But inside the fat cells, fatty acids continually cycle into triglycerides and back out again. So this is what we're interested in. You know, if the energy balance hypothesis is interested in how much food you take in and expend, okay, it's a full body idea. It's like if we wanted to know why a restaurant in Manhattan was crowded, we would pay attention to how many people went in and out of the bridges and tunnels into the city, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But if we want to know why a fat cell accumulates fat, we want to pay attention to the fat cell. And here's where energy balance matters. This fatty acid takes in more energy than it expends, right? It is going to get fatter, and that energy is going to go in as fatty acids. And if it lets out more fatty acids than it takes in, it's going to get leaner. And since you're a compilation of all your fat cells, we're going to assume you are too. So what we want to know is what regulates this. So we have the fat cell membrane. And unfortunately, I don't have a laser pointer in my... This is battery's dead, so you got to just follow it. The fatty acids get to the fat cell in two forms, basically in lipoproteins or chylomicrons. Okay, on the fat cell membrane are these enzymes, lipoprotein lipase, that'll break the fatty acids, they're in the form of triglycerides and the lipoproteins and the chylomicrons, and the LPL, the lipoprotein lipase, basically reaches out, breaks them down into fatty acids, and now they flow through the fat cell membrane. And the reason we move fat around as fatty acids is because the fatty acids are small enough to get through the membrane. Triglycerides aren't. Okay, so the reason we fix fat is triglycerides in fat cells is because they're too big to get out. It's a very simple, elegant system. So inside the fat cells, the fatty acids are bound together with an activated glycerol molecule into a triglyceride, and now it's fixed. But then there are hormones inside the fat cell, hormone-sensitive lipase particularly, that break down the triglycerides into fatty acids, and now they can get out again. So the point is, anything that increases the flux of fatty acids into the fat cell makes you fatter, and anything that increases the flux out makes you thinner, and we want to know what regulates that. It's that simple. Okay, if you just think in terms of the fat cell, pick one fat cell on your body, and this goes all the way back to Claude Bernard and the hormone milieu interior. Your fat cell only sees the bloodstream directly outside its membrane. Doesn't care about how much the body is eating or exercising. That fat cell always has more fuel available outside than inside. Your body assures that. So what regulates, why does the fat cell decide to take up extra fat? In fact, it's got to be told to take up extra fat. And in the early 1960s, it became very clear that insulin is the primary regulator of this. Yalow and Burson published this in their second paper. And you can see this didn't go away. This diagram is from Keith Frayne's Metabolic Regulation, the 2010 edition. Okay, and basically you could just see that, you know, when it comes to regulating fat storage and mobilization, it's insulin. These hormones here play some role in fat mobilization, because what a hormone is doing is telling your body to do something. And one of the revelations with Yalow and Burson's work is when they do that, they also make fuel available for that to be done. So they'll dump fatty acids into your bloodstream. But if insulin levels are high, it'll suppress even the activity of these. And if you want to get fat out of the fat cell, see, Alan Burson pointed out by the early 1960s, what you fundamentally have to do is lower insulin levels. So release of fatty acids from fat cells, they put, requires only the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. Okay, if you lower insulin enough, your fat tissue mobilizes fat, and your lean tissue will oxidize it. Okay, so here it is in textbooks. I just want to demonstrate that this didn't go away. This is a 2001 textbook. It's available on PubMed. This is a photo of a young woman who at 17 years of age was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and for the next 47 years, she gave herself her insulin shots in the same two spots on her thighs, and she developed these massive fat deposits, and this is used to illustrate a box on the overall action of insulin, which is to stimulate fat storage and inhibit mobilization. So the key points of fat cell regulation, and these are uncontroversial. So when insulin is secreted or chronically elevated, fat accumulates in the fat tissue. Okay, when insulin levels drop, fat escapes from the fat tissue and the fat depots shrink. That's in the textbooks. Textbook science. We secrete insulin primarily in response to the carbohydrate content of the diet. So that's, you know, conventional wisdom. And George Cahill, who was did a lot of this work in the early 1960s, in 1965 he was co-editor of a textbook published by the American Society of Physiology that took this 10-year revolution on understanding of fat metabolism and published in the 500-page textbook. And it's insulin driving fat accumulation and carbs driving insulin. And when I asked George Cahill about this in 2005, he was a co-author, he said, yeah, carbohydrates driving insulin is driving fat. So that's conventional wisdom. And the interesting thing is you can remove the three middle words in that sentence, is driving insulin. And you have carbohydrate is driving fat. It's logically equivalent. And now you've gone from textbook science to quackery. Okay, because as soon as you say carbohydrate is driving fat, you are now in Atkins diet land. Okay, that's why Atkins restricts carbs and lets you eat fat. And when I talk to other med schools, I often get this idea where it's like I can see in the doctors' faces, this is all very thought-provoking. And then I mention the word carbohydrates, and lo and behold, I've moved into quackery, and they think, oh my God, the guy's a quack, and we got to figure out a way to forget everything I've just said. Okay? But it's logically equivalent. Carbohydrate is driving fat. If you only care about the biology and physiology of fat cells, fat metabolism, then carbohydrate content of the diet should be fattening. Okay, and here it is again. This is Leninger's Principal Biochemistry, 2009 edition. You go to the index, look up adipocyte for fat cell, and look up what it says. It'll tell you high blood glucose from eating a carb-rich meal or being diabetic, one or the other, elicits a release of insulin, which speeds the uptake of glucose by tissues and favors the storage of fuels as glycogen and triglycerols while inhibiting fatty acid mobilization. Okay, so what makes fat cells fat? Carbohydrates and insulin. What makes a human fat? To a first approximation, obesity is a result of taking more calories in the diet than are expended. Okay, these are two different paradigms. Okay, in this bottom paradigm, the calories in, calories out thing was so profound, it's so compelling, that even textbook authors can explain why a fat cell gets fat. Keith Frayne does this in his metabolic regulation textbook. He has six chapters on fat cells and then a chapter on obesity, which is about energy balance. Okay? All I'm arguing here is that if we just look at the fat cell, if we consider this a problem of excess fat accumulation, then the upper explanation is the one we care about. The bottom one is this crazy paradigm we embraced. So here's the alternative hypothesis. Like any growth defect, obesity is a hormonal regulatory disorder. So like any growth defect, it is a growth defect, and any other one you're going to care about hormones and enzymes and receptors and genes, and that's what you should care about here. Like type 2 diabetes, it's fundamentally a disorder of insulin signaling. Okay, type 2 diabetes and obesity are so closely associated that some people consider them, as I do, two sides of the same coin, diabesity. One is a disorder of insulin signaling, so is the other. And it's triggered by the carbohydrate content of the diet. Okay? So not all carbs, not green leafy vegetables. You know, if you just look at the science again, pay attention to what's published, there are two groups of carbohydrates that you would expect to be the most problematic. The bottom level of the food guide pyramid, bread, cereal, rice, pasta, okay, the bottom of the food guide pyramid. Okay, these are high glycemic index carbohydrates that stimulate a lot of blood glucose or raise blood sugar and stimulate a lot of insulin secretion. And then sweets up at the top. So those are combinations of glucose and fructose. The fructose is metabolized mostly in the liver, and there's a lot of research, including Rick Johnson's, that suggests that fructose is a fundamental cause of insulin resistance. And once you become insulin resistant, the nutrients that you are over-secreting insulin to are the high glycemic index carbohydrates. This, by the way, begins to explain the obesity epidemic. Because in the 1960s, bread, cereal, rice, and pasta are all still considered inherently fattening. And when we started to believe that dietary fat caused heart disease, we turned them from inherently fattening foods into heart-healthy diet foods that we should all make the staple of our diets. So here's the alternative hypothesis. Refined grains, starches, and sugars stimulate insulin secretion, which lead to excess fat accumulation, obesity, and the obesity epidemic. And I'm arguing this should be the null hypothesis, okay, because it's a hypothesis that's based on biology, not physics. Okay, and then you ask the question, should this be surprising? And the conventional wisdom from the 1820s to the 1960s were that carbohydrates were inherently fattening. So there's an article, this is the first sentence of an article from British Journal of Nutrition written by one of the leading British dietitians, co-authored by. Every woman knows that carbohydrates are fattening. It's a piece of common knowledge which few nutritionists would dispute. And what's fascinating is if you go through the literature like I did, in the late 1940s and 1950s, early 1950s, I found five diets for obesity published by leading medical schools in the literature. So this is Harvard Medical School, Stanford Medical School, Cornell Medical School, Northwestern, and they're all the same diet as this one in the Practice of Endocrinology, which was a leading British endocrinology textbook. Raymond Green was a leading British endocrinologist. He was a brother of Graham Green. And this was the diet in every case. So, foods to be avoided. Bread, cereal, potatoes, the base of the food guide pyramid. Foods containing much sugar and all sweets. And you can eat as much as you like of the following. Meat, fish, birds, all green vegetables, eggs, cheese, fruit except bananas and grapes. With the exception of some of the fruit, this is the Atkins diet. Okay, and this is what was used at Harvard and Cornell and Stanford to reduce obese patients in the 1950s. And they didn't even know why these foods were to be avoided. But what's interesting is because the insulin work hadn't been done yet. But the idea was these foods are uniquely fattening. Don't eat them. And these foods do not have whatever characteristic it is that causes the human body to store fat in fat tissue. So you can eat as much as you like. It's not about how much you eat and exercise. It's about what those foods are doing in your body. And by the 1960s, we knew what they were doing. So now you can say, okay, maybe so. Look, I'll buy it. It sounds interesting. But assuredly, if you put somebody on a carb-restricted diet and you don't tell them to restrict calories, they're going to replace the carbohydrates by fat, which is what they should do. Because fat is the one nutrient that doesn't stimulate insulin secretion. And we've done this for the past decade. Since about 2000, we started studying these diets because we knew nothing else was working. A lot of physicians started studying it because they had patients who came to them and went on Atkins diet without, against their will, and not only did they lose weight, their cholesterol profiles improved. And these physicians said, I got to study this because this is against everything I believe in. So this is a summary. This is a 2012 meta-analysis of what happens when you put people on low-carbohydrate diets in randomized controlled trials. So these are carbohydrate-restricted diets where you can eat ad libitum versus low-fat, low-calorie diets where calories are restricted. And these are the results. So you remove the carbohydrates. Remember, I started off this lecture by saying that this could have been about why we get sick, what causes heart disease, diabetes, and all the diseases associated with obesity. Remove the carbohydrates, replace them with fat, and those diets are associated with significant decrease in body weight, body mass index, abdominal circumference, systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure, plasma triglycerides, fasting glucose, glycated hemoglobin, plasma insulin, plasma C-reactive protein, and an increase in high-density lipoprotein cholesterol, the good cholesterol, and low-density LDL cholesterol and creatine don't change significantly. Everything improves. In the experimental diet data, you remove the carbohydrates, particularly the sugars and high glycemic index carbs, and you replace them with fat or very low glycemic index carbs, and everything gets better. And the biology and physiology tells you this should happen. So this isn't quackery. That's one of the points. It's funny, because of Atkins, this has come with so much baggage. And all Atkins did was read the literature in the 1960s when the rest of the obesity research community was not. And there were already people who had done that before him. So this is my last slide. We asked the question earlier, why were those populations fat? And I quoted Ralph Richards. And they had an answer in the early 1970s. Most third world countries have a high carbohydrate intake as their economic dependence is predominantly agricultural with a heavy dependence on non-dairy produces. It is conceivable that the ready availability of starch and preference to animal protein contributing as a must to the main caloric requirements leads to increased lipogenesis and the development of obesity. It doesn't make them eat more. It makes them store more calories as fat. Anyway, that's it. I want to thank you for your patience. I'm willing to answer any questions. I realize this is a bit dumb. Thank you. My one request, if you have questions, is speak up, because I'm a little deaf, which is probably because I don't eat enough carbohydrates.
The last highlights of the previous slide, where you said the long-term effects of the diet don't work. So what about fat intake?
Okay, well, this is... Okay, low-carbohydrate diet was shown to have favorable effects on body weight and major cardiovascular risk factors. However, the effects on long-term health are unknown. Okay, here's what's interesting. If you do an observational study, and there are far too many of them out there right today, and they take the nurses' health study as an example, and you take women in the late 1970s and you ask them what they eat through the 1980s and 1990s, and you follow them and you look at their health outcomes, what you will find almost universally is that people who eat plant-based diets are healthier than people who eat animal-based diets. And these diets tend to be animal-based because it's much easier to restrict carbohydrates and increase fat if you're eating animal products and dairy than doing it as a vegetarian or a vegan, even though it can be done. So in the observational studies, time and time again, you will see the result that meat eating is associated with an increased risk of heart disease and diabetes and probably cancer, usually processed meats. And so it's hard to say that these diets are healthy for you if what you see in the observational studies are that over the long term, people who consume animal vegetable-based diets tend to be healthier. And so how do we explain that conflict? Because we have the experimental data over a year or two saying one thing, and we have the observational data over 10, 20 years saying something entirely different. And the answer to that is pretty simple. When my book came out, Good Calories, Bad Calories, I had a cover story in the New York Times Magazine on observational epidemiology because I believe it's a pseudoscience. So if you merely ask the question, who eats vegetable-based diets? And are they the same is people who eat meat-based diets or processed meat-based diets. So the people who live mostly are vegetarians, similar in their lifestyles to the people who eat Oscar Mayer bologna at the convenience stores is one way to look at it. And the answer is they're very different. And we know they're very different. You can actually see it in the trials, but you don't even have to. People who become vegetarians have a higher socioeconomic status. They're more health conscious. They have all their behaviors are more health conscious. They smoke less. They exercise more. They don't become vegetarians because they have to be vegetarians, even though there are vegetarian populations in India with high levels of diabetes. But in this country and throughout the Western world, people choose to be vegetarians. And now you have different behaviors. The way it was described to me by one friend, he said, it's as though in these studies they're comparing Berkeley vegetarians who eat at Alice Waters restaurant Chez Panisse once a week after yoga practice to redneck truck drivers from West Virginia whose idea of a night out is a steak and eggs at Denny's. Okay? So the question is that, are the observational results meaningful? And I would say they're not. You have to do long-term controlled trials. We actually did a long-term controlled trial. The biggest experiment ever done, the most expensive experiment, clinical trial ever done, was the Women's Health Initiative, where they looked at put women on a low-fat diet with a lot of fruits and vegetables. It wasn't aimed to be plant-based, but as they put it, they kind of threw the kitchen sink at what a healthy diet was. And it was 49,000 women randomized, 20,000 randomized to a low-fat diet with a lot of fruits and vegetables, followed for 7 years. It cost from $500 million to $2 billion, depending on who you talk to, and it had no effect, no benefit at all in any, not in weight, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, nothing. So one of the problems here is that the experimental evidence tells you one thing and the observational evidence tells you something else, and the experimental evidence is flawed, but I would argue the observational evidence is meaningless. And one thing I've done that I'm happy to talk about is actually, a year and a half ago, I founded a not-for-profit to raise money for obesity and nutrition research and diabetes research, and the idea is to do very well-controlled, randomized trials, the kind of studies that should have been done in the 1960s before we put people on this low-fat diet experiment. That's how it was described in 1980 by the head of the president of the National Academy of Sciences in Congress, because that's the other thing to remember, is when we started telling Americans to eat low-fat diets, we had no long-term data on that either. Okay, we didn't even have any good short-term data that confirmed it, but we had no long-term data, and since then, there's been an obesity and a diabetes epidemic. So it argues that we now know what happens when you put people on low-fat diets. But anyway, we founded this not-for-profit. It's called the Nutrition Science Initiative. It was going to be a nights and weekends endeavor with, I have a colleague in San Diego, Dr. Peter Attia, who's an amazing guy, and I did an economics podcast. Econ talk with Russ Roberts, George Washington University, and a couple days later I got an email from a guy who said, I run a foundation in Texas, and we don't do obesity research, but we're thinking of getting into it, and you mentioned some experiments you'd like to see funded. Rigorously controlled human experiments, like eighth grade science. Control your variables, make sure you know exactly what people are doing. Anyway, I Googled him, he turned out to be a 38-year-old hedge fund manager whose net worth was $3.5 billion, and he had a foundation. He and his vegan wife, Harvard, Yale, Oxford educated wife, had committed 90% of their fortune to their foundation with the idea of doing what they call strategic philanthropy, which is only investing in programs that have the opportunity to provide significant sustainable changes. So you don't just throw out money out there, but you look at where you can have a big effect, where you can get a big payoff. They got behind us. They have now committed $40 million for our first 3 years of research, which is going to cover about three-quarters of what we need for three experiments. But these will be better done than any nutrition experiments that have ever been done before. And we believe we can raise a lot more because there are a lot of people interested in this, and the Arnolds see this as just the beginning. So the idea is to do much better experiments, to do the kind of research that should have been done in the 1960s and done rigorously and done without preconceptions and assumptions, and see if we could kind of rebuild this field and to get independent, skeptical, influential researchers to do the experiments. We're not doing it. I'm a journalist. But we've recruited some of the best obesity researchers in the country, some of the most thoughtful people to do them. They all think this is wrong. They're all skeptical, but they also agree that the research doesn't exist to support their position, and they're willing to test, to do studies that test them.
This next question comes from Larry Hunter, who directs the Computational Bioscience Program at the University of Colorado Medical School.
First I want to thank you for being a brave journalist, coming to a bunch of docs, you do this all the time, and to try and teach us about science. But I want to ask you about the relatively new science that I think is relevant to this, and that's around the gut microbiome. And so there's been a lot of animal work, there's some good work that goes on here that suggests it's powerfully causal for obesity and malnutrition.
Yeah, I think the gut microbiome work is fascinating, okay? But the thing to keep in mind is whatever it's doing, it's got to end up, if it's involved in obesity, it has to end up changing the regulation of the fat cells. Okay? So there has to be somehow, whatever it does to the gut, to the immune system, to the bloodstream, whatever, however it changes the form of the nutrients we consume, it has to end up changing the regulation of the fat tissue. In fact, it has to end up dicking with insulin levels somehow, because that's what's regulating it. Okay? So it assuredly plays some role. And then the second question is what's cause and what's effect. So I can describe the very first experiment we're going to do. This is a consortium experiment that's going to be done at Columbia, NIH, Pennington, and the Translational Research Institute, a new institute in Orlando. And we're just going to take overweight and obese men and put them into a metabolic ward, and every 2 days out of every seven, we're going to run them. They are going to run them through a metabolic chamber to get accurate assessment of energy expenditure. At the end of 3 to 4 weeks, we could be confident that their weight's stable, and we know exactly how much energy they're taking in when their weight's stable, and exactly how much they're expending. So this is a pilot study. It's not randomized; just a pilot study to perfect the the methodology, and to know how to power the randomized control trial that follows. And then we're just going to switch them over to a ketogenic diet. And a ketogenic diet has about 5% carbohydrates. You can think of it as a tool to maximally lower insulin levels. But we're going to feed them eucalorically. So they're going to get exactly how much energy they were expending, but with a dramatically different macronutrient composition. Okay? The reason for the ketogenic diet is interesting. If you look at how insulin responds, how fatty acid turnover responds to lowering insulin levels. You can see that as insulin goes down, the fatty acid turnover doesn't really change that much. And you can have the same curve basically for mobilization or oxidation of fatty acids, because insulin suppresses fatty acid mobilization oxidation. Then you get below a threshold and it shoots up. And the problem is you don't really know where that threshold is with people. So that's kind of the logic behind ketogenic diets. The Atkins induction phase is you've got to get in here, and the way to get in here is just get rid of all the carbs, and you're pretty confident you're down there. Okay, so we're going to do that in this experiment, but again, if you believe that obesity is about energy balance, you match intake to expenditure, right, then nothing should change. Our researchers do not believe that they're going to see any difference in energy expenditure or fat mass. But if you believe that obesity is about the regulation of fat tissue through insulin, then they should mobilize fat, they should oxidize fat, they should lose weight, and energy expenditure should go up because the laws of thermodynamics. So energy expenditure is actually the primary endpoint. One of the things we're going to do is measure gut biota and how it changes. Once we can do the pilot study, which will take about a year, we will then go to a randomized controlled trial where we're randomizing the subjects to a ketogenic diet or a low-carb diet that's not ketogenic to see if there's a threshold effect, and then a control diet that'll probably be the standard American diet. We'd like to also do a very high-fat, low-carb diet, but our researchers think it's already too complicated with three diets, let alone four. In those studies, we also do gut biome research. We recruited a student of Jeff Gordon's, who's at Harvard, to do the research. And one of the things we'll find out is how the diet drives changes in gut biome. So we still won't find anything causal except that. And it won't tell us how gut biome is now affecting. But we are going to make sure that when these experiments are done, they're unique opportunities to do a lot of fascinating research in very well-controlled conditions. And so we're recruiting the best people we can to do that research. Wait, one more.
Sorry. So what do you think is a safe level of carbohydrate intake? Does one need to go ketogenic, or is there, in your opinion, yeah. I mean, and how do you figure that out?
Yeah. question, what's a safe level of carbohydrates for people? And, okay, caveat, I'm a journalist, not a doctor, right, or a researcher. And the answer is, I don't know. Okay, I do know that one of the fundamental problems with how we've approached this is we assume what's that we want to give healthy diet prescriptions for entire nation. And in doing it, we assume that what's healthy for lean people is healthy and works for obese and diabetic people. And one of the messages in this is that people who are predisposed to get fat are very different than people who remain lean. Okay, and they are the argument would be they are much less tolerant of the carb content of the diet. So a lean person could be perfectly healthy. I would say just don't eat sugar, you know, and you'll probably be fine. I mean, if you want to not eat sugar and eat white bread, you're not in a world that I understand. But sugar would be the thing to get rid of. But if you've got a weight problem, now the question is, you know, if you're 10 pounds overweight or 10, 20 pounds overweight, then just cut back and see what happens. You know, don't have pasta every night. Pasta used to be something we had Thursday nights. And then with this change in paradigm, it became the thing we ate every night because it was low in fat and it was easy to cook and everyone had their signature pasta. So you just cut back and eat less. And a lot of people, that works. I don't think they ever get ketotic. But if you're obese or diabetic or your patient is, now you're looking at it as a medical intervention. So you want to maximize the intervention. You know, get them to a healthy weight and then see what their bodies can tolerate. And to Atkins' credit, this is basically what he said. He said, don't play around. Just get rid of everything. Make sure you're losing weight. And then see what your body can tolerate. It was actually made a lot of sense. Although the difference is I'm not sure that these people necessarily could or should add the carbohydrates back. And what a lot of people find out is that when they restrict it, they can stay restricted. The question is ketosis a healthy long-term state? It's an entirely different thing than diabetic ketoacidosis, so that's not relevant, even though doctors still confuse it. Nutritionists, I think, will purposely confuse it. But we don't really know. That's open to question, too. I very much, you know, I know people who do it. There's also, some people definitely have their LDL go crazy on these diets, or even paleo diets, which don't have that much saturated fat. We don't know what proportion of those people are, and we don't know what it means, because all their metabolic syndrome markers get better. But then LDL particle number, small dense LDL can shoot up, and we don't know, is that increasing their risk? So there's a lot of things we're learning, and because more and more people are getting interested in this, more and more researchers, lipidologists, obesity, our learning curve is expanding dramatically. But the question is, again, I don't know.
Next, Rick, comes a question from the audience, from Richard Johnson, medical professor at the University of Colorado.
Yes. Can you comment on if different types of carbohydrates make a difference, starch versus sugar?
Well, this is the point. So the starches and sugars question is an obvious one, because one of the counterarguments to this is, what about Southeast Asians? They eat high-carb diets. They don't have They did not have obesity and diabetes. So, and this is, it was the Southeast Asians that drove a lot of the understanding in diabetes and heart disease towards low-fat diets, because the idea was carbs must be harmless. But they didn't understand that there was a difference between starches and sweets, and that sweets have fructose in them. And so you've got, in effect, two different phenomena going on. You've got the effect of the glucose and the glycemic index and the rise in blood sugar, and then you've got the effect of metabolizing the fructose in the liver. And in fact, in the 1980s, the ADA embraced fructose as a sweetener because it's got no glycemic index. So the glycemic index of sugar is lower than that of white bread. But the problem is they were missing the point that fructose is metabolized by the liver, and arguably we did not evolve to dump, you know, 50 calories worth of fructose on our liver in 5 minutes by drinking a soda or a fruit juice. Our bodies never saw that kind of fructose load before. And we're learning a lot about what those fructose loads does. So the way I think about it now is that, in effect, the sugar content of the diet, which includes high fructose corn syrup, is the sort of primary problem with modern diet. So if none of us had sugar, sugar had never entered the diets, and we'd all be, in effect, where the Southeast Asians were, who always had traditionally low-sugar diets, and we'd be able to tolerate the other carbs in the diet. But once we have sugar in the diets, and our mothers had sugar in their diets, and their mothers, because there are intrauterine epigenetic effects involved, then we have problems, and then all the carbs. So I don't think it's enough to just restrict sugar. I think most obese diabetic people know enough to restrict sugar, and they stay obese and diabetic. I think that's when you have to get to something pretty dramatic, which is restricting, in effect, at least all high glycemic index carbohydrates, if not, you know, most carbs. So, yeah.
So
you're next.
If you have a patient who's not obese, who's skinny, in good shape, do they need to even worry about this?
Well, I mean, the world is full of people who are skinny in good shape and have metabolic syndrome or visceral fat or liver fat. You don't know who they are. That's the problem. But, you know, I mean, you're describing most of us in our 20s, or at least most of my generation in our 20s. So the question is, had we worried about it then, would we ever have gotten to the point where we had to do dramatic things now to keep our body metabolically healthy? And the answer is, you know, I think it's worth understanding. I mean, it's worth understanding that, you know, the one fundamental argument, why we get fat, sugar, and refined grains. Why we get sick, sugar, and refined grains. Those are the problems. So it makes sense that anyone moderate those. It makes sense that anyone moderate the sugar and the refined grains in the diet. To me, healthy, unhealthy, that's step one. And specifically the sugars. You know, they might work great as performance-enhancing substances for athletes, but other than that, you just don't know. It's like, look, most people who smoke don't get lung cancer, but we don't. Unfortunately, we can't identify who the people who don't are, but we don't. And I think it's a reasonable metaphor. And what I'm arguing is that these diseases are caused, like obesity, is caused by the carb content of the diet. So a lot of people can tolerate it. But it doesn't mean it's, you know, we don't know whether it's good for it. And so I would, my baseline healthy diet would be stay away from sugar and high glycemic index carbs, and everything else is mostly fine. But again, I'm a journalist. You know, these are getting into problems that where my expertise is even more questionable than it is on everything else I said today.
This question comes from Jim Hill, who directs the Nutrition and Obesity Research Center at the University of Colorado Medical School.
Thanks for an entertaining, thought-provocative lecture. You started out saying you were looking for some exceptions to established theory. Let me give you some exceptions to yours to comment on. These are three populations we've worked with that consume very high carbohydrate diets with almost no obesity. One are aerobic athletes. They consume on a percentage or an absolute basis more carb, more sugar than almost anybody else. Second are the Amish, who actually eat a diet. They eat plants, but it's reasonable amounts of sugar and carbohydrate. Third are people in the National Weight Control Registry that have kept weight off. All these people eat high-carb diets. They're lean. The thing they all do is very high levels of physical activity. So I would argue that if you're an inactive population, carbohydrate restriction is a great way to burn fat. Another way to burn fat is to exercise, and people that do a lot of exercise generally eat a lot of high-carb diets. So I'll let you comment on that. And the second thing is, we tried this experiment in the Atkins diet. We had millions of people doing this. I don't think it had a very lasting impression.
Okay, well, let me save that last thought, because we'll get back to that one in a second. So let's start with our three groups. Aerobic athletes are self-selected, okay? So it's not a very meaningful, you know, and again, we don't know actually what happens to them as they get older. One of the leading converts to this type of thinking is a guy I'm sure you know well, Tim Noakes, okay, author of The Lore of Running, one of the drivers in the idea of carb loading. Tim ran 5 marathons a year and gained 40, 50 pounds, and he just thought that was his lot, okay, and then he thought, geez, maybe I should try giving up carbohydrates, and he did, and he lost the 50 pounds, and he now is literally, well, I mean, you know, has almost single-handedly shifted South Africa, and he's now studying ketogenic diets in aerobic athletes because he thinks you could perform better. So the question is, the problem is aerobic athletes are self-selected group. You know, I didn't become an aerobic athlete because I tend to store energy as fat, okay? I'm 220 pounds. I was 220 pounds, 240 when I played football in college, okay? Physiology is destiny, Jim, or anatomy is destiny, okay? So if I'm on, you know, 6 foot, my brother was 6'5", and you could see every vein and muscle in his body his whole life. He became an endurance runner. I became a football player, okay? He couldn't gain weight if he tried, and actually he is trying now, which is another story. And I couldn't lose weight if I tried, you know? So the question is, so this is a problem with self-selected populations. The same with the National Weight Control Registry. How many people go on to try to go on a diet every year? 30 million? 60 million? There's like 10,000 people in the National Weight Control Registry. This represents about a thousandth of a percent of the people who go on the diets. On top of that, the National Weight Control Registry is something that was advertised in weight loss clinics and hospitals that use low-fat diets. So you self-select for people who lost weight doing what they were told to lose weight. And in fact, a graduate student, a med student at Virginia Commonwealth University Medical School, recently started what he called an ancestral weight registry. And in the course of about 9 months, got 4,000 people who had lost 40 pounds or more doing low-carb, high-fat diets or paleo diets, and it's equally scientifically meaningless. It's fascinating. But you can't learn anything from that. The problem with the Atkins diet historically, there's two ways to look at it. By the way, the Amish, I don't know. There are a lot of explanations. There are problems with all observational studies. It's all observations. You know, for instance, I mentioned their epigenetic effects, intrauterine effects. As a mother gets, when she's pregnant, are we running out? We are out of time. We're out of time. And I have to talk to Jim privately. I'm going to lose my window of opportunity, right? Let me just finish this thought. There have been two ways to look at this Atkins diet phenomenon historically. One is, as I said, it was a conventional wisdom from the 1820s onward. It raised its heads in diet books, and some diet doctors got very rich writing about it. Atkins was by no means the first. But it's always been there, the idea that carbohydrates are fattening, and it continues to succeed. And you could argue that the reason it's there is because it works. But the problem is the medical research community has always perceived it as quackery. So I get emails all the time from people who say, I went on Atkins 10 years ago, I lost 60 pounds, but then my doctor told me I was killing myself. And back in 72, after Atkins wrote his book, the American Medical Association published a critique of ketogenic diets where they said they're bizarre and quackery, even though they were based on the physiological biochemical data. So the problem is, the question is, what would happen if everyone in the country actually got the right advice and the right feedback from their doctors and believed, knew why they were doing it? Because also these things are perceived as diets. So people go on them, they lose weight in the Atkins diet, and then you go off them once you get to the weight you like. And this has always been a problem with people who studied it. But if the carbohydrates are literally fattening, it makes no more sense to go back to eating them than it would to go back to smoking cigarettes after you quit because you wanted to prevent lung cancer. But traditionally, this idea that if the diet worked, we wouldn't have an obesity epidemic has been evoked since the 1970s, an argument against it, but it's been evoked by doctors who have been doing everything they can to say it's quackery and to get people not to do it. And the other thing that happens when you do it is you become kind of a social, bizarre social animal. Actually, so two people I know who do it, because there's a link between obesity, diabetes, and cancer. Okay, so this is interesting, and that's known to be mediated through insulin and IGF. So two people who do it happen to be the guy named Luke Handley, who's probably going to win the Nobel Prize someday for his work in cancer research, who's head of the Cornell, was at Harvard and is now head of the new Cornell Cancer Research Center, and Craig Thompson, who's president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Research Center in New York, the most prestigious, arguably the most prestigious cancer research center. And Craig is interesting because they both do Atkins diets to keep their insulin levels low because they think that will prevent cancer. But Craig said when he became president of Sloan Kettering, he kind of stopped doing it because suddenly he's doing all these functions and dinners, and you don't want to be the weird guy eating the steak and, you know, broccoli at dinner when everyone else is getting served pasta, you know. So it's sort of, it's almost socially unacceptable to be the weird person who's saying no to everything and having a specific diet. So there's a lot of reasons why it didn't work, and we're done because we got to go. Thank you very much.
Gary Taubes spoke before the University of Colorado Medical School, May 9, 2013. I'm Shelley Schlender. For more interviews like this, go to meandmydiabetes.com.